From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Our guiding principle remains the same as it has been from the very beginning, keeping people safe and healthy. The virus is unforgiving, as we have seen in states in the South and the West. So it's important when we see trends in our data that indicate a potential problem in any region of Illinois, that we need to start tightening mitigations in that region before it's too late.
Governor J.B. Pritzker makes some changes in a new plan to address the resurgence of COVID-19 in Illinois. We'll be discussing that. Also, we've been watching a federal investigation now for several months that has seemed to inch closer to the Illinois House Speaker and Democratic State Party Chairman Mike Madigan. Now it appears that could be on his doorstep and ready to bust right in. We'll talk about it and more on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel is practicing social distancing once again. From his home, we have Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Joining us from his home, Bill Wheelhouse, who is back reporting for public radio stations in Illinois. And our guest this week from Chicago, we have Rick Pearson, political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And Rick, it's always good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned breaking news as we sat down to record this program on Friday morning. Rick, that federal investigation involves Commonwealth Edison, the big utility in northern Illinois. And now we have the U.S. attorney making an announcement that seems to not only talk about Commonwealth Edison, but maybe implicate Speaker Madigan as well. Walk us through what is known at this time. And I just want to again say this is before a news conference that the U.S. attorney has scheduled for Friday afternoon.
Well, we have known for several months that the U.S. Attorney's Office was conducting an investigation involving Commonwealth Edison, the state's largest utility company, and its connections to operatives, friends, political allies of Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. And what we had today was basically what constitutes a plea agreement by Commonwealth Edison that they've agreed to pay $200 million and cooperate with the federal government for the next 3 years in agreeing that the company acknowledges that it corruptly offered and agreed to give things of value, jobs, vendor subcontracts, money for the benefit of House Speaker Michael Madigan and his associates with the intent to influence and reward House Speaker Madigan. Madigan is not named as a target right now. He's not charged with anything. But certainly, as we've seen federal investigations in the past, this appears to be one of those stepping stones toward the man who now has been the longest state legislative leader in the nation's history.
Well, Rick, and not only you mentioned, you know, we don't know if he is a target necessarily, but he is, or at least the public official A, is how this is identified in a news release that was sent out by the U.S. Attorney's Office. That seemed to be a bit more of an extraordinary step to take and really make it clear to people that, you know, who we're talking about here, and that is the House Speaker.
Yeah, there's plenty of the traditional alphabet soup that you find in these things, but in the actual criminal complaint, public official A was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. I mean, that's just a flat-out statement. So this isn't any supposition or anything like that. And what we've known in this investigation is that one of Madigan's longtime political allies, Michael McClain, a former state representative from Quincy, an attorney, who was a Commonwealth Ed lobbyist. The Tribune has reported that they used wiretaps on him, and he appears to be kind of, throughout the documents, and there's plenty of documents that were released today, that he appears to be kind of the conduit or nexus between Speaker Madigan and efforts to have the company fund basically part of Madigan's political army, as well as serving as a patronage army. not all of these payments were done in such a way that they could be readily identified, that they were hidden in some of the company's books, and pass-through money was made, and people were getting paid, allegedly, who were Madigan allies, for doing no work for the company at all. But this was all in an overall effort. What Edison ComEd is saying is, we paid out a lot of money to gain favor with Speaker Madigan, who, as we all know, basically controls the fate of legislation in Springfield to the tune of going back to what the document covers is from 2011 through 2019, and basically the legislature acted on legislation that Edison sought on its rate structure, which customers of ComEd pay, that would generate for the company over $150 million.
Charlie, you go as far back in state government as Mike Madigan does. I want to get your thoughts on this. I know you're not privy to anything more than pretty much what Rick had talked about there and what we've seen online from the U.S. Attorney's Office at this point, but your thoughts on what you're hearing.
Well, I've always said that Michael Madigan was a very smart politician who would go right up to the line and not cross over it. At least at face value, this appears that he may have or may have been led across by some of his associates. I don't think we know yet whether Madigan himself will be charged with any criminal act, although he is clearly identified, as Rick said. It makes it pretty clear. Usually when they use the alphabet, you have to kind of guess who the alphabet is, but this time they said public official A, the Speaker of the House, and there's no doubt who that is. But I think we'll have to just wait and see what effect this will have personally on Madigan, whether he himself ultimately is indicted, and also what effect might it have on the Democratic Party, because he's the state chairman of the Democratic Party. Are there going to be calls for him to step down while he's under this cloud? Who knows?
Bill, let me get your thoughts as well on what you've heard.
Well, I think one thing we saw prior to this is we saw the collateral damage as a number of people had to, top officials had to exit Commonwealth Edison. And now it's whether we'll see an exodus of political officials and how this will impact the Democratic Party, as Charlie mentioned. One thing, the only real statewide race they have is Dick Durbin this year, U.S. Senate, so there probably won't be much impact on this in terms of individual Democratic elections, but it could make it harder for Madigan down the road to hold on to a speakership if people feel a little more courage, since he is in the sights of the feds.
Rick, it's not just Republicans who have had problems with the Speaker through the years. There are many Democrats. And when we start talking about the Democratic Party of Illinois, in which he is the chairman, has been now for several years, there are some people who would probably like to see a change at the top. So this is the type of thing that could ratchet up that pressure, I would think.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree. I mean, when you think back to not that long ago, you had Madigan through his political aides and supporters getting caught up in the Me Too movement. And there were questions then about whether, among some Democrats, about whether, he was kind of an example of the old male guard that wasn't attuned to this kind of shift in sensibilities that we've seen. And so that's why I thought it was kind of interesting when you had Madigan talking about getting rid of the Stephen A. Douglas statues and portraits in the chamber, of trying to move ahead of something which has not been his strong suit. But now I think this could truly breathe some air into the efforts of those Democrats who believe it's truly time to reform the party. You have a party that's moving much more leftward and progressive. Madigan has not ever really been known as a progressive leader in any way. And frankly, that for Madigan, it's been mainly about keeping his job as Speaker of the House and building a political empire that basically has led to the state turning blue, controlling legislative maps that have given Democrats veto-proof majorities in the House and Senate, and all of that occurring as we see kind of a state that's becoming more progressive in the urban-suburban areas. And is Madigan being supported in those areas?
And Bill, what Rick said, I think, makes a lot of sense. At the same time, we've heard this as long as I've been involved with covering state government. And I think going back beyond that, you have people who have been, already giving the death knell to Michael Madigan's leadership that he's going to be gone. He's not going to be around. And, he continues to endure.
Well, I've always said, people have called saying this is the demise of Mike Madigan for so many years. And, it'll be kind of a bittersweet victory if he would leave under something that they would finally get him at age 78.
Charlie, age notwithstanding, Charlie, your thoughts on that as well? I mean, he's been written off before.
I will point out that I'm actually older than Mike Madigan.
Nothing about ages there, by the way.
Yeah.
How long he's been there.
But one of the things that I wonder is, will this have an impact? It's unlikely to have any major impact on Dick Durbin's reelection campaign. But on the other hand, what about some of the House members, particularly people who are elected from suburban areas that once were solidly Republican?
Right.
And because of the rightward shift of the Republican Party on the national level, those areas have become very fertile ground for Democratic candidates. Now, I wonder if this will be a counterbalance to what the polls suggest is the absolute detestation of Donald Trump up in the suburbs.
Rick, any thoughts on how this could play out on these races that are on the ballot?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, let's not forget the other statewide issue that's on the ballot is the governor's push for a graduated rate income tax. And this kind of thing could eventually play into, do you really trust Springfield with this kind of spider web of alleged corruption to take more of your money? You can argue the semantics of who gets hit by the tax, that kind of thing. But I think in a broad-based way, that could be an attack that could prove fruitful. I mean, obviously, we've had Republicans for, decades pointing a finger at Madigan and using him as kind of the target of the point man for everything that's wrong in the state of Illinois. And you had Pat Brady, a state Republican chairman, with the fire Madigan. You certainly had Bruce Rauner, who tried to make Madigan the entire issue of Republican politics. Republicans, without Bruce Rauner, they don't have any money, but they may have an issue. And for them, their task, as Charlie points out, in a state and area was where Donald Trump is deeply unpopular, the job for Republicans now will be to try to localize these legislative elections, truly make them much more parochial to Illinois. But the question remains, do they have the finances to be able to pull that off?
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, joined by Bill Wheelhouse, Charlie Wheeler, and our guest this week is Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We'll be talking more about Speaker Madigan, I'm sure, on coming shows, and we will be continuing to follow this situation, the breaking news, as we sit down to record this program before the federal prosecutor's office in Chicago delivers a news conference on Friday afternoon. So, again, we'll continue to follow that, and we will update more next week on our program. Let me turn to Governor J.B. Pritzker, because, Rick, you covered this week when he announced changes to how the state basically will be tracking COVID-19. He made some changes in his plans. Walk us through just basically what he is talking about here.
Sure. I mean, when you remember when the governor came out with his Reopen Illinois plan and basically broke the state down into four significantly sized regions, and that these regions would be the ones that the state would individually look at as far as metrics, as far as increased positivity among testing, among available hospital beds, available ICU beds, all of those things broken into that kind of large regional multi-county tracks. Now the governor is taking a much more targeted, localized approach. Instead of four regions, we have 11 different zones. You had some counties complaining that they were being lumped in with larger metropolitan areas, and they viewed that as unfair and not reflective of the facts on the ground in their counties. So you do have these smaller groupings of counties, and I kind of see it as a way that the state can do a more targeted mitigation if they have to, without having to do widespread shutdowns, widespread closures that could affect vast swatches of the state should coronavirus spike up to seriously high levels. So I, in a way, it's almost like, if you remember, the debate over reopening Illinois at the beginning was very much on a kind of a regionalized basis. And now it seems truly that he's adopting that localized regionalization approach as we see the positivity rate starting to kind of tick up slightly here in Illinois from as low as 2% to 3.1% in the most recent numbers. So I think it provides more options for the governor and the state to step in if there are serious spikes that develop.
Charlie, I want to get your opinion on this, because certainly we've been hearing from many people, Republicans and others, who've been saying we need to break the state up a bit more when it comes to these regions, just what Rick had talked about there. At the same time, as you have mentioned and many times on this show, this state does not operate in a vacuum. We have people who are, you know, traveling in different places, so maybe you see a spike up in one area and you have to shut things down does not necessarily mean people are not going to travel to another area. So does it create problems doing it this way?
I think it does, in that sense that we're all in this together. And the fact that somebody maybe lives in Chicago doesn't mean that they can't drive down to Springfield. But I think, as Rick said, the ability to target more strategically and pinpoint areas of spikes is much better developed now than it was when the first plan was put out months ago. And we have a much greater testing capacity. We have the beginnings, it's not fully implemented yet, of a contact tracing program that will enable public health officials to figure out where did this spike come from and to react pretty quickly. And I think what the data suggests and what the public health officials and the governor and the mayor, Mayor Lightfoot, are saying is that one of the problems is younger people who kind of feel invincible and decide, hey, I can go to the bar, big deal, or I can go to the beach. And as a matter of fact, there was a story in the Trib the other day where a whole host of Tribune reporters interviewed young people, and kind of my sense is that they're really not that concerned. If they get it, it's not a big deal. And so I think that's where the danger is. And if anything were to happen, I suspect the next step will be to close the bars down again.
And Bill, the governor has indicated he's willing to move the state back to put these types of, you call it mitigation, if you want to call it that, mitigation restrictions in place that would shut some things down if the situation warranted that.
He has, and they've done it in a way that it would be likely bars and restaurants or something of that nature, but it comes at the same time as they're talking about whether schools will start in session, and that just gets a social media rumor mill going. And so there's just a lot of competing interest out there as they set these metrics. And then one school district mentioned today that they cover three counties, and all three counties are in different zones that the governor has set up. So you encounter kind of odd situations in that respect. But I think the warning that came out from the governor was kind of a preemptive strike of trying to say, let's fix this, let's be cautious, and without requiring mandatory face masks, although a lot of businesses and grocery stores are now requiring them across the state and elsewhere.
I'm getting back.
Go ahead. Point out too that in looking at these new regional metrics yesterday. Now, granted, they were roughly 3 days behind, but that the state appears overall to be well within issues involving hospitalization, positivity rates, those kinds of things, but that there might be more concern over in the region that's the Metro East area across from St. Louis. And obviously you have people who routinely cross the border into Missouri, which has much less restrictions placed on its people. And there looked like a place that needs to be have an eye kept on, where the positivity rate was around 6%, and there's kind of an automatic imposition of shutting bars, restaurants, and everything if those rates prolong at a positivity rate of 8%, as well as issues involving the availability of hospitals to handle any surge.
Charlie, the governor and the State Board of Education giving some wider latitude to school districts to develop plans for how to get kids back in the classrooms. But already we've heard, I guess, three different school districts, only one of them a public school, that decided to basically not require kids to wear the masks when they come back. And the governor and the state attorney general are going to court to force that issue. We may, I guess, see more of that as the next few weeks come along.
Yeah, and in fact, the governor and the education state school superintendent have basically said school districts can decide themselves what's best for them, whether they're going to do online or in person or a combination. But if they do in person, there's certain things they have to do, including requiring everyone over the age of 2 who's medically able to wear a face covering at all times in the school facility. Now, Thomas DeVore, the same lawyer who's been involved in filing, oh gosh, I don't know how many suits contending the governor has no authority to do this, is representing, as you said, three school districts. One is the Hudsonville Community Unit School District number 1 down in Crawford County, which is in southeastern Illinois along the banks of the Wabash River. Another one is a private Christian school in Shanahan, up in the Chicago area, and another one in Yorkville, also in the Chicago area. And DeVore, on behalf of these schools, sent a letter to the state saying, we are not going to do face coverings. And so earlier this week, the governor and the public health director and the state school superintendent sued in Sangamon County, arguing that this attitude on the part of the schools, and I'll read what it said from the complaint. The school's refusal to comply with the governor's executive orders and the guidance will cause immediate and irreparable harm, including by undermining plaintiff's ability to cohesively respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. And in fact, Pritzker added a statement. He said, as a father, I would not send my children to a school where face coverings are not required because the science is clear. Face coverings are critical to prevent the spread of coronavirus.
And Rick, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, we talked on the show last week about her being a contender as Joe Biden's potential running mate. She made some national TV appearances again in the past week, getting, again, more attention. And the Illinois Democratic Party also endorsed her for that position. Does this mean anything going into this political season?
I think it's some good symbolism on behalf of the state. It was something that Senior Senator Dick Durbin pushed the state Democrats to do. But in the grand scheme of things, it's Joe Biden's pick. And each of the women that he's considering all bring different things to the table. Certainly with Tammy Duckworth, it starts with the story and then her defense of veterans and military and her complaints about politicizing the military. It's just a matter of where the vice president wants to go on this. And I think anything could happen at this point.
just about a minute and a half or so left here. And Rick, you wrote about this. President Trump this week making an announcement that something from his administration is coming to address crime in cities like Chicago. What do we know about what he's saying here?
That's a very good question. We really don't know. I mean, there has been this constant back and forth between the president using Chicago as an example of what he says are liberal Democrat-run cities where crime has gone out of control. Certainly, we all know about Chicago and its gun violence problems, but it's more, I think, the complaint being that Trump is using Chicago to try to score political points on his law and order kind of support and all of that in the midst of the still aftermath of how the world is changing with the George Floyd murder and police custody in Minneapolis. And so we don't know what he's planning. He's talked about doing a federal takeover, not exactly clear how that could happen. Asked the governor about it, and he just said it's just kind of basically more of the Donald Trump political bluster.
Okay, we'll continue to watch for that. Let's go now to our notes from the field. And Bill, let's start with you.
Yeah, Sean, it was just kind of funny. I saw a Illinois Senate Democratic tweet today, and it was regarding weather, but I thought in lieu of the political climate, it might be a device or a fortune cookie. Illinois Senate Democrats said, stay cool, hot, humid days are coming, and they certainly are politically.
Charlie?
Well, there's been a lot of attention paid recently to issues involving people of color in this nation and how for many years they were deemed second-class citizens, and changes are being made. We've talked about doing away with the statue of Stephen A. Douglas, for example, or Pierre Menard, who were slaveholders. And one little indication of how attitudes may be changing, the city council in Murfreesboro, which is a town way deep in southern Illinois, voted recently to rename the Town Center Park after one of its most influential black educators, Carl Lee, who in 1916, as an 18-year-old, tried to integrate Murfreesboro Township High School. He later was a teacher there for many years, and he was one of the first black graduates from what was known as the Southern Illinois Normal School back then. We know today, of course, it's Southern Illinois Carbondale.
And Rick?
We all know about the complaints about the people are having with trying to get unemployment benefits at the Department of Employment Security, some changes being made with a callback system. Nevertheless, the complaints are still major, and I think even though we've seen Republicans complaining about it, Democrats are doing their share as well. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a full-blown audit of the Department of Employment Security at some point. And one cautionary note there, it's entirely likely that we're going to see in this rush to try to extend benefits to people, we're likely to see some fraudulent payments being made.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Bill Wheelhouse, and Rick Pearson, political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.